Tonight our 40-minute speaker is Marianne Kay from Santa Monica.
Hi, my name is Marianne, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm real glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be sober, but I don't see any time things anywhere. Is there a clock? Okay. Oh, fabulous! Yeah, because I usually kind of can time it in my head, but just in case, I don't want to get carried away and only be in the fourth grade and it's time to sit down. I'm real glad to be here tonight, and hope you're all having a happy, comfortable holiday season, a Merry Christmas. And I celebrated almost everything this year. One of my girlfriends has a Hanukkah party, and I celebrated that, and I've celebrated Christmas. And so I'm enjoying myself. I moved away from Iowa, which is where my home is, in 1963. And I've always worked either in gambling when I was in Las Vegas, or restaurant work after I came over here. And now I'm a retail sales clerk. So I've always been busy working at Christmas time. And I made up my mind up years ago that I wouldn't worry about getting home at Christmas time. And so I don't get homesick at Christmas time, because it's never occurred to me that I was, to go home. And those first few years, of course, I was a drunk, and it's much easier. I remember one time when I went home to visit my mother, my mom and dad. I thought, oh dear God, now I've got to figure out a way not to make a fool out of myself while I'm here at home. Because I was a bad drunk. I didn't drink for very long, 11 years, but I gave it everything I had, and I was a real bad drunk. I was born, and I've been sober since August 4th of 1969. And by the way, it's very nice to see Elaine and James, and happy birthday to you, James. And I'm glad that you were at the meeting. I'm glad you remember me kindly being secretary of that meeting. That was a very, I'm sorry for jumping around, but I'm going to do it anyway. So many people who've been secretary of our big meeting have enjoyed it and have really enjoyed it. And it was hard for me. It was really hard. And I'd be so, my guts would start tightening up on I'd relax a little bit after the meeting was over, and maybe till about the weekend I'd be okay. And then about Monday I'd start tightening up again and worrying and fussing and stewing but I guess it turned out right. I liked standing at the door and saying hello to people, and I liked making the announcements. And pretty much that's all most people remember about me, is standing at the door. They said you could always remember my name, and the announcements. I tried to make them succinct and reasonably interesting, and so that's all anybody remembers. Those are the only two things I really enjoyed about it. I'd be so nervous, and I would hang on every word the speaker said and dissect it and fret and stew over that, so. But anyway, that was my experience with the Wednesday night meeting. Of course, I'd have been heartbroken if I hadn't got elected. So, but anyway, I've been sober since August 4th, 1969. I celebrated 40 years this year, and I'm grateful for that. I was born in 1940. I'm 69 years old now, and I was born in Iowa and brought up there, and I spent the first 23 years of my life there. And I didn't drink until after I got out of high school. I'd always had fantasies about being a movie star or an entertainer of some kind. Some of my earliest heroes were, does anybody remember Al Jolson? I loved Al Jolson's voice. And I can remember my mother telling me that, they had movies about Al Jolson. Al Jolson, the Al Jolson story, and Jolson Sings Again and all that. And a man named Larry Parks, who was very handsome, played Al Jolson. Because Al Jolson was not that good-looking a guy. And I remember my mother saying to me once, when I was extolling Al Jolson's virtues and how wonderful he was, my mother said, Marianne, he doesn't look anything like Larry Parks. But that wasn't it. That was that voice and the emotion that it generated in me. And I wanted to be able to do that to people. I think I felt... I imagine most little kids feel kind of powerless simply because you are. Your folks are running your life and everything. You've got to go to school and the teachers run your life. But I think that I've always had an innate sense of powerlessness. And I think that I thought at that time the only people that I saw, women, that seemed to have any power were women that were entertainers. Now, I remember one woman politician, and I have no idea what she did. Her name was Claire Booth Luce. That's the only woman I remember from that era. I mean, now we have a lot of, if women want a little power, you know, you're able to get it. But I think that was probably had a great deal to do with my fantasies about being a starlet, was the idea that it would give me some sense of power. And, of course, when I hadn't been discovered for the movies, because God forbid that I would say, Mom and Dad, I'd like to see if I can get a scholarship to go to the University of Iowa and maybe I can study dramatics. I just gave up. When I hadn't been discovered, I gave up. And my mom was a beauty operator, and so I went to hairdressing school. It was something my folks could afford. The school was close to where I lived, and I didn't object. And, you know, and on one way, that's fine. But on the other hand, how quickly I let go of any ideas I had, you know. How quickly I just let go and said, okay, how quickly I was willing to settle for something I knew I wasn't going to be any good at. Look at my hair tonight. You can, I've pulled it up and I've tied it in a knot and put a bonnet. But another digression, I'm not going to have to worry about my hair too much longer because for reasons I don't know why, it's falling out. So it's not going to be too long before I'm not going to have to worry about my hair at all because there isn't going to be any. But that's just one of those things. So anyway, I went off to this hairdressing school, and I think the most significant event was the fact that I started drinking when I was a student there. I was invited out one night by some people who were a little bit older than I was on a blind date, and they drank, so I drank. And I went from somebody out for the evening to somebody the book describes very accurately, and that was the alcoholic is very rarely mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. And that was certainly applicable to me that night. I knew that I was behaving erratically and I couldn't stop. So two things started right from the beginning of my drinking. I was powerless, and I had a personality change in that I went from being kind of a nice, kind of gawky teenager to being this crazy woman. And the next day, I think, is as significant as the drunk, because I think anybody can get drunk that's not familiar with drinking. It'd be really, because, you know, after you drink the second or third one, you can't taste it anymore, and it's just, you know, it's just like drinking water. Or anyway, that's the way it was to me. And I assumed that might happen to other people, but you'd have a little sense the next day and say, you know, that was probably not the best idea I've ever had. Perhaps I'll be more careful the next time. And somebody came up to me, a man friend of mine who was a little bit older than I was, and said, I heard about how you acted last night when you were drinking. And, you know, it could be that you're one of those people who just shouldn't drink. And I don't think it'll surprise anybody in this room that I said, yes, but, and started defending my right to drink from the very beginning. And I can also tell you that the next time that I remember having an opportunity to drink, I did not give a nanosecond of thought to how I behaved the first time I drank. And it was rather an important occasion. I was in Des Moines taking my state boards. And it was a two-day event. We did the rolling up, the hairdressing one day, and we did the written test the next day. And these things were important. And I went out and got drunk that night with some girls. And I didn't get quite as stupid as I did the first time, but I got stupid enough and obnoxious enough that one of the girls I was with, you know how a bunch of girls will go out, and if they're reasonably attractive, a bunch of boys will suddenly materialize. And one of the girls that I was with felt constrained to apologize to some of the men who had joined us for my behavior. And I became, from that time on, somebody people talked about while I was still there, you know. And I have a friend named Marion, who's in a longtime sober woman, who's been a very good, kind mentor to me over the years. And I'm always grateful to her because she mentions this from time to time when she talks about how she was somebody like that. People would say, where's her purse? Did she bring a coat? You know, and there's just that idea that you're just standing there and people talk about you as if you were almost an inanimate object, you know, that it just no one says, where's your coat? You know, and that was part of it. But that's a small price to pay for the relief that alcohol gave me, because, you know, folks, and I'm sure that I'm not alone in this, life was not easy for me. I had an easy life and it was hard. I don't know what I'd have done if I'd had any real hardships. But life was hard for me. I couldn't seem to adapt. I had kind of I have one of those brains that's kind of useless in a way. Because I get real high marks on IQ tests, but yet I can't do anything. I'm absolutely can't do anything. I'm just kind of useless in a way, really. In many ways, I wasn't a good hairdresser. It was awful. And life was terrifying for me because I didn't seem to be able to do anything quite right. No matter how hard I tried, nothing ever worked out for me. I wasn't popular with boys until I started to put out. And then that really isn't, you know, that for the most part is not, especially we're not talking about now. We're talking about the late 50s, early 60s. These are not long-term relationships that are developed, in situations like that. And it just adds to that feeling of kind of uselessness. I just didn't know what to do with myself, but when I drank, I didn't care. And that's one of the things that alcohol always did for me from the first time I drank it till the last time I drank it was I didn't care. And not caring is as good or better than being able to do something. I've got another friend that talks a lot in groups, and maybe you've heard him say this, about how having a few drinks and he could sit on his sofa and say, job well done. You know, it just, there's that sense of accomplishment, that having a few drinks, that sense of ease and comfort that the book talks about, and also kind of a sense of accomplishment for having done absolutely nothing. And I just didn't care. So that's kind of how I stumbled along. But, you know, I wasn't getting anywhere in my life, and I eventually had to go home and live with my mom and dad. I graduated from hairdressing school. I did a few jobs as a hairdresser. I wasn't very good at it. And the one job I did have a little following at, I couldn't wait to get away from and go someplace else. And then I got tangled up with a man I had no business going with in the first place. And that got bad. And not behaving well, but he wasn't a bad guy. It was just that it was totally a bad situation. I had no business going with this man. He had a commitment to somebody else. And I jumped right in there and didn't care. Because when I drank, I didn't care. I didn't care about you. I didn't care about the kids you'd spawned. I didn't care about anything like that. I just wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. But I knew there was a part of me that cared and knew I had to get out of this situation and didn't know how I was going to do it. Plus, I couldn't get a job. I just could not do hairdressing anymore, and I couldn't do anything else. So I went home and lived with my mom and dad. And I got a little job that was sort of the forerunner of something that I did for many, many years thereafter. I got a job working for the Elks Club, which is a fraternal organization. And back in those days in Iowa, you could only buy liquor by the drink at these places. Anywhere else, you had to take your bottle with you, order what they called a setup, and then pour your liquor into it, which is a truly hideous way to drink. But at the Elks Club, you could say, give me a bourbon and seven. So it was very, and I went to work there and did some bartending and did some food service. And I liked it, and I was halfway decent at it, you know. But I continued to drink, and it came to my parents' attention how badly I behaved when I drank. And this promiscuity and the just awfulness of my behavior when I was drinking. My dad used to sit up at night and my dad was kind of one of those heavy drinkers that was able to stop when it was medically indicated, but at that time he was still drinking, and he used to sit up at night and drink a few beers and read the newspaper, and, you know, he was waiting for me one night, and I sat down and talked to him, and he said, you know, you can live any way you want to, but if you're going to be here at home, you have to live in such a way that you're not an embarrassment to us. And I knew that I was going to have to do something about my drinking, because I knew that the kind of behavior that they were embarrassed for took place when I drank. I have a little bit of self-control when I'm not drinking. I may be a little bit odd, but I'm not going to do anything so bizarre that people are going to call my attention to it. And so I knew I was going to have to do something about my drinking, so I decided I'd just drink three beers or three shots or whatever, and that is grim drinking, because sometimes three will get the job done, but most of the time it won't. Not that I was that big I don't need a lot of alcohol to make me drunk, but it just gave you that kind of icky feeling. So I just said, I just quit drinking entirely, and it wasn't too bad. I was in my early 20s, and the only thing about not drinking is then my mind is cleared. And remember, one of the reasons I drink is because of what goes on in my head when I'm not drinking. And I have these fantasies, but I treat them as if they were plans. You know, there is a difference between a fantasy and a plan, but not in my life. And so I started thinking, you know, I'm only 22 years old. I can still become a starlet. And I had a feeling, I'm a small town girl. I'm not a city girl. And I knew that I couldn't make it in New York or Los Angeles. That would be too big and too terrifying. At the time when I was formulating these plans, Las Vegas was not a big city. It was a very exciting place, but it was a small, it was really, I think there was only about 80,000 people living there at the time. And so I moved to Las Vegas as if that would be a nice place for a neurotic young woman to go to. And so off I go to Las Vegas, and three days after I get there, I start drinking. 2 months after I start drinking, I'm in the county hospital mental facility taking Thorazine. And, you know, if my problems were strictly emotional, I believe that would have been the answer. And I'll tell you why. I met a psychiatrist there who was very, very kind to me and I think really did take an interest in me. I mean, we all like to think that we're special to the psychiatrists who see us, but he seemed to have had a real kind of an interest in trying to help me come out of this mess that I'd gotten myself into. He saw potential, if you will. And he told me to do some things that I actually did. I have a real funny last name. My last name is Looney. And it was a terrible embarrassment to me. You know, most people outgrow stuff like that. Or, you know, and it just, I didn't. I didn't outgrow it. And it just was torturous to me to tell anybody what my name was. And so he said, why don't you change your name? He said, you know, it looks to me like you have all the trouble you need. Why don't you call yourself something else? And so I did it. And also about this, I'm 70, you know, close to 70 now, and I know nobody wants to hear about a 70-year-old woman's sex life. You know, and when you're 70, it seems like you've always been 70 to the people you're talking to. So I'm not going to get too deeply involved in that. But I did, you know, I was kind of casual with my affection, and he said that, you know, why don't you make some effort to see to it that you don't bring children into the world that you can't take care of? And I did that. And it made my life easier. But I did not drink one drop less. See, solving those problems, there's a guy, I don't know if he's still living, if he still goes around and talks, his name is Ski. And he was in the military, and he had some very valuable training, so the military wanted to keep him because they had a lot invested in him. And he talked about how when he went to the doctor about his drinking, when he was forced to, he said, well, here's the reasons I drink. And he wrote down all these reasons that he drank, and they fixed them all. And then he had to come up with other reasons because there's something that alcohol does for me, and apparently did it for Ski. There's something that alcohol does for me that I need to have done. And it doesn't matter how my life gets fixed. I was quite well thought of at the work I did in Las Vegas. It wasn't a big job, but these people they were very well connected, and I might have been able to amount to something because they liked me. But I just simply couldn't not drink and get in the kind of messes that drinking always brings to me. Eventually, I had to leave Las Vegas. Now, I'm not that popular with men, as I mentioned, but I'm always running away from a man somehow. I team up with these people that I just eventually have to run away from, and I had to get away from this guy. So I came over to Southern California, and I drank for another 4 years. And I had a brief period of recovery. I mean, recovery is a relative term. In the late 60s, for one thing, I had finally latched on to a job that I could do fairly well and make a living at, and that's I became a coffee shop waitress, and I've done armed service waitressing for 38 years. In 2003, I got kind of eased out of my last job, and so now I do retail sales clerking. But from 1960, I worked in taverns when I first came to Southern California, and then I got a job in a coffee shop, and from that time on, which was about 1965, 66, from that time on, I was an armed service waitress for 38 years in various places. And anyway, I uh, I met this young man. His mother and I worked together, and I'd had one boyfriend here in Southern California that wasn't such a bad guy. And when we parted, I didn't have to run away. I moved, but I didn't have to run away from him. And this young man and I teamed up together, and for the first and only time in my life, really, I wanted to get married and have a family. I'd never felt that way before, and I haven't really felt that way since. But I wanted to get married and have a family, and I believe on reflection, it didn't seem like it at the time, but upon reflection, I think that perhaps this desire, not that he was unworthy of these feelings, but I think my desire to marry him and have a family with him was my last ditch attempt to fix myself. I've always known there was something wrong with me. My earliest question, a question about life was, what's wrong with me? What the hell's wrong with me? And I think that this I thought it would be something normal. I'd get married, I'd have a few children, I'd have a life. It wouldn't be a movie star, but it'd be a life. And of course, I didn't stop drinking. And my drinking took that last irreversible turn. I'd had a little reprieve because we both drank. This was the late 60s, and there was a lot of drugs going around. Now, I've never been much of a drug user. I come from a time when if somebody said, are you holding, what that meant was, do you have Benzedrine wrapped up in a little tinfoil that you'll sell me 10 of them for a dollar? Can you believe it? That's a pretty good high, too. 10 Benzedrine pills for a buck and a few 10-cent draft beers. That's a good drunk. He used more drugs than I did and everything, but he was still having fun with it. And I was now drinking medicinally. I was drinking because I couldn't stand the way I felt when I wasn't drunk. When I wasn't drunk, I was filled with a kind of terror that I can't really describe. It was so awful. Just a terrible, 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 that fear. You know, sometimes you don't know what people are talking about. And when I got here to AA, I didn't know everything that people were talking about. Some of it puzzled me. But two phrases that I understood immediately were fear of impending doom and pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Both of those expressions, I didn't have to turn to the person next to me and say, what do they mean by that? Because I knew, and I had this terrible fear of impending doom that was allayed by drinking alcohol. Not only would it take it away, I would feel like I'd never had it. And then the next day it would start over again. And so he finally left me, and then I just felt kind of doomed after that. And it wasn't long after that. We were together on the 20th of July when the man walked on the moon. He left me, and I got sober on August 4th. So he wasn't gone very long. He was my last great hope. And he was gone, and I knew he was gone. And he had left me one other time and came back. But this time I somehow or another knew that he was gone. So I got sober. On August 3rd, I went out, and I had started a new job. I thought maybe if I had a different job and different things to think about, I wouldn't be so weird. And, of course, I'd left a good job to go to a not-so-good job, and I thought, what was I thinking? So I got drunk that night, although I said I wasn't gonna. And I woke up the next morning on August 4th, and I somehow or another knew I couldn't go on living any longer the way I was living. I didn't know what I was going to do. I just knew I couldn't go on any longer. And so I went to work, because I've always gone to work through all of this foolishness. I've always worked. I've always paid my bills. I've always paid my own rent, sent Christmas presents home. You know, I really tried to be a citizen. I think I voted in most elections, you know. And so I tried to be a citizen. But I had this terrible, terrible need to drink. But I went to work that day, and I was cleaning off a table in the restaurant where I was working, and the thought occurred to me, why don't you try AA? And I haven't had anything to drink, and I haven't taken psychiatric medication from that day to this. And because the last psychiatrist I went to, I said my problem, he thought my problem, you know, was my nerves, and he gave me some Librium. And I don't like downers. I can't remember what it did to me. It either made my tongue numb or the back of my head numb, one or the other. And I didn't like it. And I'd even talked somebody into giving me some Thorazine, and that made me weird too. So I was just a drinker. And so I went home from work that afternoon, and I was standing at the foot of the stairs of my apartment, and I said, well, if I'm going to go to AA tonight, I guess I won't go over to Pete's this afternoon. Pete's was the little neighborhood bar that I went to every day as soon as I got off work. I didn't even go home and change out of my uniform. I just went right in and started drinking, and I didn't go that day. I have to assume that that is grace. I don't know. I certainly didn't earn that reprieve. I didn't earn it, but I did follow through on it. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous and found out where a meeting was I could get to, and I called my mom and dad back in Iowa and told them I was going. I made a commitment to doing it. And I don't know what I did from then until I went to the meeting. I just know what I didn't do. I didn't drink. I didn't take any Delibrium that was laying around the house. And I didn't get scared. For some reason or other, the first few days I was sober, I wasn't scared. I was in a fog, but I wasn't afraid. And so I went to a meeting that night, and people were nice to me. I raised my hand as an alcoholic after they encouraged me to do so, and also as a newcomer. I started to shake real bad after that. And I said, oh, this is ridiculous. I didn't drink that much. I think it was a combination probably of withdrawals and terrible nervous. I'd had a shake and fit like that once before in my life when I'd been seeing a guy again. This is when I was real young, seeing a guy I had no business going with. And I thought that I got caught at it, and it was his wife coming to catch me, and I started shaking so bad that the comb in my hand flew up in the air, and it was just nerves of, my God, what have I done, and how am I going to get out of this? And I think that's the same kind of shaking I was having that night. I looked around, and I just admitted to all these people I was an alcoholic. And you know, if you admit to my way of thinking at that time, if you admit you're an alcoholic, that means you're not supposed to drink. And so, what have I done? But anyway, I quit shaking after a while, and they had some speakers, and I remember the guy's name, and his name was Jerry, and I remember what he looked like, and the only thing I remember him talking about was he said it was all black and white, there was no gray. And I don't know what that meant to me, but that's what I remember out of his talk, but whatever it was, it spurred me forward. And somebody gave me a big book after the meeting, and somebody, I don't know who, gave me a ride home. And so I went home and I went to bed, but I took some of the literature to bed with me. They not only gave me a book, they gave me a whole bunch of pamphlets. And I started to read that stuff, and I was just fascinated with it. And I fell asleep that night, and I woke up the next morning when the alarm clock rang. And I had not slept a night through, and I can't tell you how long. I don't sleep the night through now. But that first night I was sober, I slept the night through, and I was aware of it. When I woke up the next morning, I was aware that I had slept that night through. And I went to work that day, and I went to the meeting that night, and I'm pretty sure this is true. I've been telling this story for years, so I hope it's true. That the second night I was at the meeting, I'd been sober for 48 hours, and I got called on. And I was maybe like the second person called on, and it was my first participation meeting, because the night before had been a speaker meeting, two speakers. And I got up and I said my name, said I was an alcoholic, and said a few sentences appropriate to the situation and sat back down again. And that doesn't sound like much, but for years, people had been trying to help me to just sort of fit in and be a part of things. My poor dad used to say, Marianne, just be yourself. Well, you see, I thought that what he saw was myself. I realize now what he was trying to tell me was, don't put on all these performances and wave your arms around and talk so loud and say these kind of silly things. Just kind of relax and be a part of things, you know. Fit in with, look, you know, I think part of fitting in is looking around and see what's being done and then emulating it. It's easy to do when it's something awful. It's real easy to look around and want to fit in and be a part of a bunch of bums and thugs. But if you're in a kind of a nice environment and you pay attention to what's going on and do it, you'll be okay. In Alcoholics Anonymous, from the beginning, I was able to do that. Now, you know, that doesn't sound like much, but it was a lot to me. And a lady named Mige was very good to me during my early days of sobriety. She sort of took me under her wing and took me to meetings, and we went places together. She took me to a meeting one night and recommended me to be one of the speakers, and I'd only been sober for 3 weeks, and I got to give a 20-minute talk. And again, I didn't make a fool. I probably was a little bit precious, but I didn't make a fool out of myself. I know that. I've never cringed over that talk, you know. I have no memory of cringing over it, and I was a great one to cringe, because I'd do something and then I'd cringe. And I don't remember cringing over that talk, so I must have done all right. And it was really very touching to me that somebody, because she was well thought of, you know, people knew her by name, I was very touched that somebody that elegant and that well thought of would recommend me to speak at a meeting that she was a regular attender of. So, you know, things started to turn around for me a little bit, and I started going to these meetings, and And I held down a job, and I stayed at the job I had taken, you know, in an effort to fix myself. I didn't last very long. There was only 30 days, and I thought, I was bankrupt in every department but financial. I've always been kind of frugal. And I had, just before I got sober, I'd worked 30 days in a row. Our boss let us work 30 days in a row while somebody went on vacation. Instead of hiring somebody, he let us, me and another woman, he let us do the work. So I'd saved up a little bit of money so I could afford not to work for a little while. And I took 10 days off, and then I went to another job, and I hated that one too. But all the time I was going to meetings and trying to do the right thing and following Mize around, and then Mize started to, I think she had to do some traveling out of town, and I, in the meantime, had sort of started sniffing around some of these meetings with some kind of interesting people in them. They, you know, they were just enthusiastic and really, you know, upbeat. It was very upbeat, and I was starting to hang around them, and I latched on to a young woman named Alice who became my first sponsor, and I was following her around, and going to meetings, and I think I started going to the little birthday. We filled up our Clancy's living room. We were still having him at his house at that time, but we'd go to the parties afterwards. And I tried to fit in. And Alice was so good to me. You know, I firmly believe that when the student's ready, the teacher appears, and it doesn't seem to matter how smart the teacher is as long as the student is willing. Because I don't know if I was smarter than Alice, but I know for a fact that I thought I was. And yet I was willing to follow her direction. When she told me to do something, if I did it, things got better. If she told me to stop doing something and I stopped doing it, things got better. Mize is in heaven. If there's a heaven, Mize is there. Alice, I don't know where she is. I've lost track of her. I mention her name every time I speak in the hope that someday I'll see her again, because she was very, very instrumental in my early sobriety. And I finally, you know, another thing I did was I finally went back to a job that I'd quit that I knew I liked, and I hated that job too, and it suddenly dawned on me that perhaps it was me. And I remember one night listening to Chapter 5, and by that time, I was 5 or 6 months sober, by that time, I'd heard Chapter 5 time and time again, but this night, I really heard this where it says, and practice these principles in all of our affairs. And I got to thinking, uh-oh, I bet that means I have to do this at work, too. Now, I'm the kind of waitress that I don't steal from my coworkers. I don't try to get your big tipping customers to sit in my station. I do my side work. I'm willing to help you with yours. But I just have this little thing, you know, I'm nice to nice people. I know I have to do that. I know that. But I also feel an obligation to sort of punish people that I don't think are behaving, not just for me, but every time, maybe if I teach you a lesson, you won't do this to the next waitress you come in contact with. And so, and I was a little bit temperamental when I was new because, you know, I don't know about the rest of you, but I bet I'm not the only one here like this. You know, I could say, bring it on, you sons of guns, because in a few minutes, I'm going to be out of here, and I'm going to go over to Pete's and have a few drinks, and you'll still be you, but I'll be feeling a lot better. Well, you know, now I don't have that. Now I'm just there, and there's not really any easing off of it. But I got to thinking, maybe that was a signal. When I heard that, it was a signal to me to start kind of doing things. And I started trying to be a little bit nice to everybody. And I didn't know how to do it at first, so I've always done side work, but I started to do a little bit more side work, like moving the deuces that were in the middle of the floor and sweeping under them, because the guys, when they cleaned, just went with the mop up and down the aisle. And I started sweeping in the cracks, not every day, but I had a routine. I can't remember if it was once a week or once a month, but I would get in there with the whisk broom, not just on my station, but on everybody's station, and try to do that. And I really tried, because I don't know how nice I could be to people that I didn't like, but I figured everybody would be in a nicer environment if I kept it cleaner. So anyway, I tried doing that, and, you know, it was a long, slow process, but I'm sure glad I did it, because I was able to last as a waitress with these bad legs probably longer than I could have, because I start letting people help me, and people wanted to help me, so I was able to stay on as a waitress probably longer. My last waitressing job was, there was a bunch of other crabby old women like me, and I think that I took a leave of absence. Never take a leave of absence for any length of time, because they'll find out that they can get along without you. And he asked me if I'd mind retiring early, and I didn't want to fight with them over it. You know, I was heartbroken. But they've been good to me. These kids have been good to me. And they were the third generation running a deli up in Beverly Hills. So I figured they got enough trouble. They don't need me weeping and gnashing my teeth and threatening to go at the union. I said thank you for the opportunity. And because it had been a good opportunity. I'd worked there one time before. And then 15 years later, they took me back again. And it was a good deal. So, but that was the end of my waitressing career. But when I was new, I tried to practice these things, and slowly but surely I started to get a little bit better. And when Alice wanted to start going to other meetings, I looked around and I saw these people that I liked real well and I was very impressed with, and they all had the same sponsor. And so I decided to ask that man to be my sponsor, not because I wanted what he had. I didn't know what he had, but I wanted what the people he sponsored had. I wanted to be like them. And so I asked clients to be my sponsor. And for the most part, he's been my sponsor since I was a year, just a little bit less than a year sober. And for a few years in the mid-70s, I had a woman for a sponsor for a while. And she was very good to me, and I'm grateful to her for what she did for me. But for the most part, Clancy's been my sponsor, and we're still trudging the road to happy destiny together. So I'm grateful for that. But I started to kind of become a part of that, of the group at that level. And he got me to learn to drive a car. You know, I you can probably tell by the way I'm jumping around that I'm kind of nervous and high strung. Even now, 40 years later, I'm a lot calmer than I ever thought I'd be. But I am by nature kind of a high strung, intense, kind of fearful, giddy person. And, I never did drive because I just felt like I would not be good at driving. You know, I took driving lessons and I had a car for a while, and it was so terrifying that I just got rid of the car and quit. But he told me to learn to drive a car, and I promised him I'd do what he asked me to do. So I learned to drive. I can remember him telling me, I don't know whether he told me this or not, but I remember him telling me this, learn how to drive so you can give back some of what's been given to you, and you've been given a lot of rides. And, you know, I firmly believe that the difference between the therapy that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous and the therapy that I tried before that, however well-intentioned, the difference in a lot of ways is, number one, of course, I'm physically sober, but also because of the component of being of service to other people as a necessity. That we're not occasionally being nice to people from time to time to make ourselves feel good, like throwing $5 in Santa's kettle at Christmas time, but that we are consistently called upon to lend a hand to other people. In whatever way, if nothing more than showing up on a meeting on a night when you're tired, or giving somebody a ride home that bores you to death, or, you know, those kind of things. The fact that there's an obligation, if I want to stay sober and be reasonably comfortable, that I'm going to have to be of service to other people. And rather than just concentrating on how I feel about myself and the reasons for all these mental quirks that I have. You know, because one of the things that I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years is this. I have a lot of things wrong with me mentally and emotionally. I really do. I try to keep them reasonably, you know, I try not to be too visible about them. But believe me, there's things that are not quite right about me. But one of the things that I have discovered is that if I treat my alcoholism very aggressively, I can treat the rest of my problems with kind of a benign neglect. You know, I don't concentrate. For example, I get very fearful at times. I've always had anxiety, and I still have anxiety. I just march along. I say little prayers. God, if this is something that needs to be addressed, show me the way. If this is just my nerves, help me to march on. And then I march on because I figure if there is something wrong and I march on, I'll collapse, which is what's going to happen anyway. If there's nothing wrong and I just march on, I'm fine. I remember one time I went through a phase where, and I've been sober for a while, where going down to the promenade, where I now work in Santa Monica, going down to the promenade, I would have terrible attacks of anxiety. And it occurred to me one day that I was dying. And I thought, well, I'd worked at a restaurant called Zookie's for a while, and I still had some friends who worked there. I thought, I will go up to Zookie's and tell them that I think I'm dying, and they'll help me. Well, I walked along for a while. I thought, oh, won't that be embarrassing if I go in and tell them I'm dying, and then I don't? Won't I feel silly? And so I just kept on, and eventually it went away. And another time, I was walking down La Cienega Boulevard, I was headed someplace, and all of a sudden, again, it occurred to me, and I'm not talking about when I'm 6 months sober. This is well into double-digit sobriety. And it occurred to me that I was dying. And I said to myself, I saw it was either an UPS truck or a FedEx truck, but those guys that drive those trucks are usually pretty nice guys. So I said to myself, you know, I think that I'm probably dying, but I'm going to keep walking, and if I still feel this way by the time I get up to that truck, I'm going to ask the guy if he'll help me take me to the hospital. And by the time I got to the truck, I was okay. So I've learned little ways of, I don't know if that's benign neglect or not, but I'm not running to emergency hospitals all the time. And sometimes it gets the better of me, and I try to limit my visits to the doctor with my long list of ailments to once a year, and then I trot out all my ailments, and I get tests and I'm fine. I remember one time when I went to the doctor, he wanted me to start taking Valium. And I said, no, I don't do that. I'm an alcoholic, and alcoholics have a hard time taking these drugs. If it doesn't make them crazy in the first place, quite often they start drinking again. I don't want to take that risk. And he asked me to consider the fact that he had to treat me, and that, you know, that he felt that I had to give, you know, that I had to help him treat me by taking what he suggested. And I said, doctor, I will sign any paper you want me to sign that relieves you of any responsibility for me if I die from lack of Valium. You are off the hook. So that's kind of how I treat the fact that I'm a little bit of a nut. I worked as a waitress for many years, and of course I wanted to be a starlet. What time am I supposed to stop? It's 9:15. Okay, I'll sum this up real quick, but I never did become a movie star, even though I kind of wanted to. I took singing lessons and dancing lessons, and I took a few acting classes. And I will say this, in my late 50s, I had some headshots done, and I went out on a few auditions for things, and I will let you know that I made enough money to pay for my headshots. And I kind of called it even, and if I live to be 70, I will have lasted a whole decade without having headshots or going out and auditioning for anything. And so, but you know, what happened, what was nice about all this was, you know, I've seen people who stayed sober and I think did okay, but there was always just that underlying current of terrible disappointment that they hadn't got what they wanted. And I will have to say this, because I've heard at 5 months sober, practice these principles in all of our affairs, and kept that kind of waddling around in the back of my mind over the years and practicing it, I put enough effort into waitressing that I really got where I enjoyed doing it. And I'm not a particularly good waitress, but I won an award. I was Waitress of the Year 1 year with the California Restaurant Association. And I wasn't Waitress of the Year because I was such a good waitress. I was Waitress of the Year because my coworkers thought enough of me to write a letter nominating me. That's why I got it. And so I was able to enjoy the career I actually had rather than sitting around weeping and gnashing my teeth because I wasn't, because I hadn't become a starlet. And now this, for the last, you know, when I was truly heartbroken when they let me off. It wasn't like getting fired because they liked me. It was simply that they really didn't need me and I was already gone. It's easier to keep me gone than to let go of somebody. And they actually did me a favor because with these crippled legs, I shouldn't be carrying dishes because if my legs go and I throw food all over somebody, I'll never forgive myself. If I fall down at the Pottery Barn, I might land on a sofa and I'll be fine. But anyway, as I've been working for a lifestyle store since 2003. Because, you know, when I realized I wasn't going to work for them anymore, my restaurant people, I laid down on the sofa and sort of said, who am I, for about a week. And then it occurred to me, whoever you are, you need a job. So I had to get up and I went back to work and I like this and they're good to me and everybody's a lot younger than I am. They've hired a woman that's kind of, she's not my age by any means, but she's closer to me than most of them are in age. And they're just so good to me, these young kids. And they let me make ask them the same questions over and over again, you know, because I can't. There's certain things I just don't quite get. And I got hit by a bus in 2002, I think. I was crossing the street, and the next thing I knew, I was on a gurney. And I said, what happened? And they said, you got hit by a bus. And I got to be honest with you, I've never been quite the same since then, you know. It's not bad, but I notice that, you know, I can't. Now, maybe it's because I'm getting older, but I can't quite hold on to things. I don't catch on as quick. And once I catch on, I can't hold it. And they're so good to me, you know. And so I'm grateful for that. And God, they worked me like a rented mule the last 2 weeks. We were busy. And I was in there every day. And one girl had, one, that older woman called in sick. And I don't think she was sick. I think she was just tired. But by God, I was there. So anyway, I'm glad. I hope we all have a comfortable, sober 2010. And I'm very grateful. Betty, I had to cancel this because my brother was very sick. And I was afraid he was going to die. He did die, but he didn't die when I thought he was going to. And so I offered to come on Christmas night because I figured the traffic would be lighter and I knew I wouldn't be working. And sometimes it's hard to get somebody to come out on Christmas. And I love being able to come out and share on Christmas night because I'm grateful for AA. And I can't think of a better place to be than at an AA meeting on Christmas night. I wish you all the best and thank you for having me. And happy birthday, James.